Wolf number 690 lost her pack to disease and was forced to flee the protected confines of Yellowstone Park for the wilds of private property. Her run into the wild leaves us to ask, who's afraid of the big bad wolf?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 690th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Milan who are tuned in as we stream along in the radio page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Michael.
Hey, kind of weird, huh? We're doing show number 690 about wolf number 690.
Ooh, tricky.
A genuine coincidence, huh? Well, folks, the wolves of the Druid Peak Pack in Yellowstone Park's Lamar Valley got famous by hanging out close to the highway, where they became the target of a million cameras. Being famous, however, did not ensure the wolves' survival, and one after the other, they succumbed to disease and attacks from neighboring wolf packs. Thus, Wolf 690 from the Druids, a two-year-old female, found herself alone and shunned by neighboring packs. She was forced out of the protected confines of Yellowstone Park and into the wilds of private property. When 690 crossed over the park's border, she broke into a run, and she ran, and she ran, and she ran. She ran over 150 miles before going on the hunt to satisfy her hunger. But what can a wolf hunt when she is tired, hungry, and stricken with mange? She can hunt that which is easiest to hunt, right? And thus 690 was seen hunting cattle by the rancher who owned those cattle. That rancher also owned a rifle, and he used that rifle to put an end to the wolf on the run. Wolf 690's story leads us to consider what happens when the needs of wolves conflict with the needs of people. And so we ask today, who's afraid of the big bad wolf? And who better to take us on a hunt for an answer than Carolyn Syme, who is the Wolf Program Coordinator for the Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks. Carolyn, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be with you today.
Good to have you aboard. I always wanted to ask you this question. See, I can't even coordinate my daughter's two dogs. So how do you coordinate all of these wild wolves?
Well, that's a bit of a misnomer in my title. I actually don't coordinate the wolves. Most of my work is focused on the human component and trying to coordinate anything from our monitoring program, how many wolves are on the landscape, to working with people who live directly with the animals.
Is it any easier to coordinate people than wolves?
I don't think so. Sometimes it's about like herding butterflies. Uh-huh. Certainly the wolf is a pretty dynamic animal, and that human-wolf relationship is every bit as dynamic, if not more so.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, my father-in-law likes to tell a story about his grandparents who homesteaded eastern Montana. They built themselves a little sod house out there on the prairie. And they brought in some horses from the Black Hills of South Dakota and staked them out. You know, they used the horses to plow the grounds, of course, and so they were camped out there in this little sodbuster house, and one night the wolves came and chased away the horses. And so the grandpa, he walks, literally, back to the ranch in the Black Hills where the horses were purchased and where they ran back to, and all along the way, the wolves were at his heels, quite literally, following him, looking for a way of getting to him. And meanwhile, back at their little sod house, the grandmother was being forced to chase wolves away by just banging on pots and kettles and whatnot. And, you know, in those days, we developed quite a fear of the wolves, and so we chased them away and did in with them, essentially. We exterminated them from the environment. And yet here, you know, 70 years later, we're bringing them back. Why are we bringing them back?
Well, it has been a remarkable journey for all of us. You know, one of the reasons that folks wanted to bring them back is to bring a top-level predator back into the ecosystem. We've learned a lot. Ecology and our understanding of ecosystem processes has come a long way since those days, and certainly adding a predator back to the environment brings a component back. One of the things that is interesting is, you know, one of the reasons that wolves are built and do what they do is based on the wild animals that they eat. And mm-hmm. that's why deer and elk are built and do what they do. That's why the antelope can run so fast. So everything's connected, and we've got lots of great writing out there by Aldo Leopold and many others to talk about those kinds of relationships.
Mm-hmm. And what did we miss when we, you know, did not have that apex predator of the wolf around? What was the ecological component that was missing in that relationship there?
Yeah, well, certainly one of the components that was missing had to do with the balance of the numbers of deer and elk, for example, mm-hmm. And the numbers of carnivores or predators that hunt and eat them, and the things that the deer and elk eat. So there's an ecological term for that. It's called trophic cascade, where there's a relationship all up and down the food chain.
And in Yellowstone Park, I think they've even demonstrated that it has a profound impact on the landscape and on the plant life of the landscape as well, correct?
Uh-huh, that's right. Not only do you have the relationships in terms of the plant life and the animals, but also there is a behavioral component. Where having that risk factor of being chased and killed by a wolf causes the elk to behave a little bit differently, and certainly some of the research would bear that out.
Mm-hmm. And how did you become part of the wolf landscape as a person? Just out of business.
Oh.
How did Carolyn Syme end up in the wolf country?
You know, that may be the greatest mystery of all. You know, I had been working as a professional wildlife biologist, primarily in the research world, with fish, wildlife, and parks, up in northwest Montana, and this was an area that wolves had naturally recolonized on their own beginning in the late 70s and the early 1980s. That was back before the days of Border Patrol. So mm-hmm. wolves basically just started recolonizing Montana in an area where I was doing intensive research on one of their primary prey species, which is the white-tailed deer, at least in that part of Montana. And I had a really good handle on the data and what the data showed about that relationship between white-tailed deer and wolves. And yet there was that human component, and I found that at times they were not in alignment. What I understood about the nature of, you know, wolves and whitetails was very different what people were telling me in terms of how the whitetail were doing.
In what respect?
Well, you know, basically our perceptions of wolves oftentimes can be very negative in the sense of they compete with me as a hunter, so white-tailed deer populations are down in areas where there are wolves. So that was a common refrain from folks. And yet I understood, based on the intensive research that I was doing at the time, that the white-tail population was robust. It was as healthy and strong as ever. And so that began my nascent curiosity in this human-wolf relationship. And so at that time, not many years later, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, was thinking about that reintroduction into Yellowstone Park in central Idaho in an effort to recover wolves faster and delist them sooner. And each state needed to have a management plan that talked about how they were going to maintain that recovered population when it came time for delisting. And so it was an opportunity for me to switch gears a little bit, move out of the research world, bring my knowledge of science and research into the human dimension of
this. You became a politician then, didn't you?
No, well, some have said that. I'm not sure I believe that. Sometimes that has a negative connotation, doesn't it?
No, I don't think in this case it does, because if you think about all of the elements that you have to bring together and make work, you know, that would be the good sense of what a politician might do.
Well, there's a lot of problem solving to it. Absolutely, there's a lot of problem solving to it. There's technical components. Certainly, there are legal components, of course. And then there's that human component. And we all need to cross the finish line together, so to speak, in order to find ways to live with this wolf and this animal on the landscape. I mean, they kill and eat things we care about, you know, whether it's our livestock or domestic dogs. or deer and elk that folks hunt or hunt for food. And so finding ways to get that balance out there where things work, mm-hmm. You know, you're right. It is finding a new way of being after 70 years of this animal being gone.
So in those 70 years, you know, at the end of those 70 years, I guess, we came to realize that we needed to bring the wolves back because the environment was simply out of balance. There was something very important missing, and that important thing was the apex predator of the wolf. And so we came to the conclusion that we're going to bring them back. And that must have been an interesting decision to make. When we come back from this break, how did we reintroduce wolves into the West? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking the wolves. Are you afraid of the big bad wolf? I think I would be if I met one out there in the wilds. I did see one out there in the wilds, and it was absolutely stunning. We're talking with Carolyn Syme, who is with the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, a couple years ago, the family was driving through Montana's Gallatin Valley one winter day and cruising along. It's an absolutely beautiful, snowy landscape, and wife Marlene suddenly said, "Stop, wolf!" And I stopped. Sure enough, there was a wolf just 25 yards off the road, and the wolf was stalking some mice underneath the snow. You could hear him listening to the mice as they were scurrying about in their little snow tunnels, and he'd jump way up in the air and then pounce on the snow, and we just stopped and we just watched, and oh my goodness, there's a wolf. And there are wolves throughout Yellowstone Park now, and we're going to talk about how they came to be reintroduced to Yellowstone and ecosystem, and then throughout the West as well. We have Carolyn Symes with us. She's with Montana Department of Fish, Game, and Wildlife, or something like that. I'll get it right. Carolyn, who made the decision then to bring wolves back into the West? Oops, let me get a punch the button here. There you go.
Very long conversation, Michael. In fact, before the decision was ultimately made, there was about a 20 to 25 year conversation. Basically, it began with passage of the Endangered Species Act under the administration of President Nixon. And the wolf was one of the very first species that was listed back in 1973 and then 74 when the act was ultimately finalized and passed by Congress. And thus began the odyssey of recovering species that that were near extinction, very, very rare in the landscape. And from there, the next question was, well, how should we recover all these species? Certainly the wolf was not the only species that was listed upon passage of the act. But there was a very, very long dialogue about that. There are legal requirements under the ESA, but certainly we've modified the landscape to the point where, you know, we have livestock out there and folks, mm-hmm. You know, obviously we purposefully killed all the wolves because of conflicts not only with livestock and homesteaders, but also concerns about big game populations, so deer, elk. By that point in time, bison, of course, were gone.
Sure.
And so there's a lot, an awful lot of conversation and discussion that took place. Congress was involved and directed a series of studies to look at the feasibility of the reintroduction program, feasibility of what would happen as animals radiated out of Yellowstone National Park or Central Idaho. There was a recovery team, a recovery planning team that was brought together, wolf experts from around the country. And so they set about some principles and a plan. The plan was ultimately modified, and then some subsequent studies came along, and one thing led to another. And, of course, it wasn't an easy conversation, you know, because there are...
I imagine there was some dissent.
That may be putting it mildly, so to speak. And with a lot of controversial topics, sometimes ultimately they go political. And, mm-hmm. and that at that point, that's when Congress got involved and directed studies. Long story short, ultimately you get to the point where the decision was made by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service director at that time, who was Molly Beatty. And I've read a little bit about her. She was really an interesting woman. And not long after the animals were released into the pens in 95 in Yellowstone Park, and animals were released in Central Idaho in the wilderness areas, she was stricken with cancer. But she ultimately was the one that made that decision.
Wow. So how did they reintroduce wolves? I mean, they selected, of course, Yellowstone Park and the wilderness in Idaho because they were relatively protected areas for the wolves, right?
Absolutely, yeah. These were areas that offered large blocks of public land with very, very low densities of livestock, and also areas that had very healthy, rigorous populations of deer and elk. And so the food resources were there. At the same time, at the time of the first release in 1995, the state of Montana already had a minimum of about 66 wolves and approximately 5 to 6 different wolf packs in northwest Montana. So the recovery team had delineated a recovery area that encompassed Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
Now, what kind of wolves did we reintroduce into the American West? Were they?
Is that a fair question? Wolves.
They were the kind that were there before?
They were the kind that were there before, although science, of course, as you know, is a process. And so through time, the taxonomy has been revised. The lumpers and the splitters, you know, had their pendulum swing. So at one time, folks thought that there were approximately 22 different subspecies of gray wolves. Then the lumpers came along, and so now we're down to 5 subspecies of gray wolves. In the end, these animals were taken from one place in Alberta, one place in British Columbia. They were very familiar with deer and elk as a primary prey species, which, of course, they had a lot of experience with those, and so they were released in areas that had a common prey item. Wolves can be 70 to 80 pounds. Some large males might go to 100 inside Yellowstone. Some of those animals are a little bit over 100 pounds. And so those, basically, it's the same animal.
I saw where one was weighed at 143 pounds in Yellowstone.
Probably had a full stomach.
That's big. I saw a wolf pelt a couple years ago when I was up in the Paradise Valley of Montana that measured from snout to end of tail 7'2". That's a big animal.
It is a big animal. Their biology is pretty amazing. They're built and they're geared to run. All of their morphology, the way the body, the bones mm-hmm. are built, the muscle structure, they're a very, very large and powerful animal.
And they're built to run, and run they do.
And run they do.
So we reintroduced them to Yellowstone Park, and, of course, it didn't take very long for them to kind of max out their holding capacity, right, I guess? You might say the holding capacity of the park.
That is a fair way to say that.
And so we have a good, healthy population in the Yellowstone Park, and so when new wolves come along, there's no place for them. So they go away, and they leave the park. And then what happens?
Right, and so when wolves leave Yellowstone National Park, they can walk into the state of Idaho, the state of Wyoming, or the state of Montana. And basically when they leave the park, as far as the wolf knows, the landscape looks the same. You know, you've
right,
got forested areas, you've got open areas, you've got deer and elk. But the big thing that changes, of course, is that you add us to the landscape and human uses of the landscape.
Mm-hmm. And private property.
And private property. And livestock, cars, trains, you name it.
So in the planning process, you knew this was going to happen. How did you plan for it?
Well, Montana has always had a very, very strong tradition of involving the public, particularly for large and controversial things that affect them. So Montana's approach was to gather a group of citizens, and it was known as the Montana Wolf Advisory Council. And one of the things that you learn very, very quickly, of course, is wolves are controversial, and there's a lot of different value systems about wolves. Everything from wolves are the spawn of Satan to wolves are the savior of the earth akin to Jesus Christ, and everything in between. I mean, not to belittle any position here, but just to sort of capture that spectrum. So clearly wolves are in the eye of the beholder, and these are very, very deep-seated value systems that can be triggered by wolves. So Montana gathered a group of 12 citizens, and they came from all walks of life, all across the state, from very, very different backgrounds, to represent hunters, livestock interests, wolf advocates, the general citizen who may like wildlife, may or may not hunt, maybe not, doesn't raise livestock for a living. And you ask them to come together and to provide recommendations
because
to the technical wildlife professionals about how you reconcile those disparate values. It's not necessarily a technical question, Michael. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
Well,
I am
it's a
wildlife
political
professional.
Question.
Is it, well, in a sense, yeah. In a sense, yeah. I mean, politics sometimes gets a bad rap, but you can also think of it as groups of people making collective
decisions. How else are you going to bring 12 disparate viewpoints together to get... You had to tell them the wolves are coming, right? Here comes the wolves. How are we going to deal with it?
And there's
12 different people there. So that's an incredible political maneuvering to get that kind of to get any kind of decision out of 12 different people is amazing. But to get a decision on wolves is truly amazing. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Carolyn Syme, who is with the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And she is the coordinator of the wolf program. She doesn't coordinate wolves, but she coordinates the wolf program. And you, if you have questions about wolves, we're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. And today we're talking about wolves, the reintroduction of wolves. You know, over the 70 years that we had no wolves, we come to recognize that there was something really profound missing in our ecosystem of the West, and we decided that one of the things that was missing was the wolf. And so we brought the wolf back, and we parked their butts in the beautiful confines of Yellowstone Park. Well, it must have been paradise for a wolf. If I was a wolf, that's where I'd like to hang around, because there are all those ungulates hanging around just waiting to be eaten. Must have been like a smorgasbord for them. What do you think, Carolyn?
Oh, certainly it was like being released into
paradise.
Something that they hadn't seen before, but they knew exactly what to do.
They knew exactly what to do, yeah, eat. Eat or be eaten. So we were planning on, we knew that the wolves were coming. We brought together these people, different groups, and we sat them down and said, the wolves are coming. How are we going to accept them? And so how on earth did you accept them? The first thing you did, of course, was that they were protected, so nobody could do anything with them anyway, because they were listed under the Endangered Species Act, correct?
That's correct.
So they were protected animals. You could not shoot them unless they were, you know, doing you wrong or something like that, probably.
Uh-huh. There were some regulations that allowed folks to protect their livestock if they actually saw the wolf chasing, killing, or attacking livestock. And other than that, basically the goal was to grow wolves on the landscape, so to speak, so more wolves in more places until the recovery goals were achieved, which mm-hmm. meant enough wolves in enough places, the population was secured. The other component, of course, was the states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming each needed to have management plans that addressed how we would conserve the species over the long term.
And the wolves did spread. I understand that there are wolves in Oregon now?
There are a couple of packs in eastern Oregon and one over towards northeast Washington, and then in the Cascades of Washington that appears to have started from animals that drifted south from British Columbia.
Okay, so they're gradually populating the American West down in Colorado?
There have been a couple of wolves actually from Yellowstone Park area that have dispersed to Colorado. Both of them were killed. One was hit by a car just outside of Denver, so that's a pretty long, pretty long distance movement. Wolves are great travelers. The biology is very robust. They're very, very great travelers, and it's amazing to see records like that.
Yeah, they're built for the run, right?
They're built to travel, exactly.
Well, we're going to go to the phones right now, folks. If you have anything that you'd like to ask or say about wolves or about reintroducing wild things into the wilds of private property, pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 831-479-1080 in the Central California area and 800-624-2665 everywhere else. We're talking with Carolyn Syme, who is the Wolf Program Coordinator for the Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks. Let's go to Rolf. Rolf, who has got some experience up there in the Rockies. Rolf, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning.
Welcome aboard.
Howdy. I have a farm in Canyon Country on the Utah-Colorado state line, and I actually actually last year did see a wolf on the farm.
Single wolf?
Yeah, single wolf. And my question is, in my business dealings in agriculture in Montana, between Luther and Red Lodge, a dear friend of mine had a large ranch in which I spent quite a bit of time, and he was convinced that as long as the wolf was free range and was decimated, that the wolf kept the coyotes essentially in the numbers in check. And my question is there any confirmation, has any studies been done that the wolves used to keep coyotes in check? And my follow-up question is, why are we still, obviously the fear of wolves is ridiculously out of range or proportion as to what these magnificent animals do to people. Why we're not considering that the wolves, just like the coyotes, just can be all over the country rather than go and just make this big menace out of them. I'll rest my case.
Okay, thanks, Rolf. Two questions there. First one, wolves and coyotes.
Yeah, so wolves and coyotes are in the dog families, and so is the fox, and basically it's the same family as our domestic dogs at home.
Big dog, little dog?
Big dog, little dog, and so there is a bit of a hierarchy in terms of behavior. So wolves can be very, very aggressive towards coyotes and kill coyotes from a behavioral point of view. From a food point of view, coyotes, since they're a little bit smaller animal, basically focus on smaller food items. Mm-hmm. So deer, rodents, marmots, ground squirrels, that type of thing. But dogs are dogs, and coyotes will scavenge carcasses that are left by wolves. Wolves can sometimes wolves come back and feed on those same carcasses. Maybe the coyotes are present. The wolves will chase the coyotes away from the carcass. So you could say that there is that bit of a hierarchy there.
Well, wolves also kill wolves, don't they?
Wolves will kill wolves. In fact, that's the leading cause of death for wolves in Yellowstone National Park is wolves killing other wolves. They can be very, very aggressive towards each other. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and that second question, if you could reiterate that for me.
Well, why are we so afraid of them, and why can't they be just everywhere like coyotes?
Oh, okay. Why are we so? Yeah. So actually,
this gets down to the core question, right?
It does get down to that core question, Michael. And I'm beginning to think there's something hardwired in genetics here, because the wolf-human relationship and the conflict there really goes back thousands and thousands of years, and so it's not unique to our time, and it's not unique to the last 70 years, at least in this country. Anyway, it really goes back to old Europe. And some of our fairy tales, Little Red Riding Hood.
Probably forever. It probably goes back forever.
I'm beginning to think that. But the irony to me sometimes is that we domesticated wild wolves to create our dogs. So genetically, wild gray wolves kind of look the same in a petri dish to a geneticist as a chihuahua or a black lab. So We need to talk to an anthropologist, I think, to get all of that part sorted out.
Okay, we're going to go back to management when we get back from this break. And I am truly curious as to how you go about managing wolves, because there are three different states involved in maybe four or five now, or six or seven or eight, or the whole entire West will be managing them on a state-per-state basis. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about how Montana developed its management program and how it differs from some place like Wyoming, for example. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking wild wolves in the wildness of private property. What happens when wolves escape, you know, the friendly confines of Yellowstone and go out and meet us? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones and join us. Well, folks, they are magnificent. They're wild. They're on the run throughout the American West. The wolves are back. The question is, how on earth are we going to manage all that wildness amidst all of our private property? Because the wolves, of course, they have their needs, and we have our needs. So how do we bring the two together so we can all just, like Rodney King says, just get along? Well, here to help us figure it out, we have Carolyn Symes, who is with the Montana State Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And I guess the key moment in all of this is when the wolf is delisted, right? Because that's when each state reveals what it's going to do to manage their own wolves, correct, St. Carolyn?
Uh-huh, that's right. The goal of the Endangered Species Act is to recover species, get that species so it's secure on the landscape, and delist them so they can be managed and conserved at the state level. Mm-hmm,
And the wolves have been delisted.
The wolves were delisted, at least in Montana and Idaho, in May of 2009. So Montana has had the full reins, so to speak, to conserve and manage since then. Although Montana was on the ground even before that through a cooperative agreement with the federal government so that we could be gaining experience and learning more about the animal and how to work with it and that wolf-human interface.
And those bad boys down in Wyoming?
Wyoming is still working at it. I think that might be the generous way to phrase that. Wyoming has some things that it's working on.
It has some issues.
Yeah, some issues, I guess. Maybe the more honest way to say that is the federal government has ultimately rejected the Wyoming management approach, and they're in court as we speak.
So Wyoming suggests its management is going to be open season on all wolves.
In a portion of the state, right.
Okay, and the federal government says, well, wait a minute, you can't do it like that. You have to have some kind of manners about how you go about managing your wolves, correct?
That's right.
And then until you come up with the manners, we're not going to delist the wolves in Wyoming, so that's kind of the situation up there. Well, how on earth do you manage wolves? You have a hunt, right?
Right. So we have in this country a long history and tradition of the hunter conservationist as an important tool in managing the numbers of wildlife. And that really comes to us from, you know, for example, the Teddy Roosevelt tradition, where you have the hunter then with very structured regulations. They pay money, they pay taxes. That has been the primary funding source for wildlife restoration efforts across this country.
Isn't that the most profound and wonderful irony, is that it is the sportsman hunter who really is responsible for returning all of the various wildlife to the landscape?
It's a remarkable story. It truly is a remarkable story. They restrict themselves, they tax themselves, they regulate themselves. And it is basically has been a benefit to this country and basically the world, you know, in terms of the system of wildlife that we have in this country. It's valued all over the world.
So Montana established a wolf hunt. And this year, I understand, you doubled the amount of wolves that you're going to allow to be taken.
We did.
Any controversy in that decision?
Oh, of course there is. You know, we have folks who say, you know, you shouldn't be hunting. It's too soon. They were just delisted. You don't have that much experience yet. And there is a grain of truth in that point of view, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's also a grain of truth in the point of view that says, hey, we can't have unlimited numbers of wolves running all over the place just doing whatever it is they want. And there's an element of truth there as well. And so really what we're trying to do with our hunting season is to balance the fact that wolves are a public resource valued by lots of people for all kinds of reasons, but there are private property concerns, of course, if you raise livestock for a living. Clearly, you know, if a wolf kills your cow, not only is the animal dead, but you're out the money. And clearly life is different. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, a value system that restores wildlife to ecosystems. But if you raise livestock for a living, your life is fundamentally different now.
The
hunting season, we're trying to balance a lot of different objectives, both that work for the wolf and work for people.
This is a quote from Carolyn Symes. If everyone is a little upset and nobody is getting exactly what they want, then you're right where you need to be. Is that how you see your role up there? As a wolf program coordinator, pissing off everybody just so that you can walk down the middle somehow?
Well, there's a grain of truth in that as well. You know, this balance of public resources and private property, that is a difficult balance to make. Some would have you err towards, hey, public resource, you know, this is what I want, and some would have you err towards, there's no room for wolves on a landscape ever anywhere.
Right.
And so no one is going to get everything they want. I like to think that we still live in a democracy where we try to balance, we deliberate as a people, and we try to balance competing interests.
You know what Ben Franklin...
Everybody gets a little bit...
You know what Ben Franklin said about democracy?
What did he say?
Two wolves and a lamb talking about what's for lunch. We'll be right back with Wayne. We're going to take a quick break. Hold on, Wayne. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Carolyn Symes with the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And you were talking wolves and the reintroduction of wolves into the American West. And the wonderful conflict that it brings up when you have the needs of the wild wolves and the needs of private property. And you, inevitably, they're going to come to blows. And how do you resolve that? So that's the question today. When we come back, we're going to go to the phones, 800-624-2665, 831-4719-80. Right back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Carolyn Syme and you, 800-624-2665, 831-4719-80. Wayne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Fascinating program. I think I got a wolfie, and I had a question about that. First of all, it's been eating out of the food bowl. I know I'd put food out there, then boom, the food would be gone. I see the dogs are doing it, but I was looking one time, and I saw this small animal with a funny nose, very timid, come down to the food bowl and go back out again. I think he might be a wolf, and the question is, are we supposed to put food? He's very emaciated. If it's a girl, or I can see the bones, you know, the ribs. Should we put food out or not food?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question, Carolyn.
You know, I would say not. Actually, I think at least in Montana, our approach is to keep wild animals wild, and,
right, okay,
and not everything's going to make it out there.
Okay.
It sounds a little bit like, to me, like it might be a stray dog or some sort of hybrid.
Right.
And in that sense, that might be something that you would refer to your local animal shelter or your local animal control authority with the county, for example, or the city if you live within city limits. But generally, at least in Montana, our guidance to citizens, don't feed wildlife.
Right.
Bears in particular can habituate, wolves can habituate to food sources, and so keep wild animals wild.
Right. I'm bordering right on the wild country here. I'm up in Brookdale, up in a canyon. If you go over my hill, you're at Loch Lomond. Or if you go over my hill, you're in Love Creek. So that one hill in between has all of these animals on it. The other question is the deer. Deer sleep next to my house because, you know, I live alone and it's pretty private. Do these wolves bother the deer, or do the deer bother the wolves, you know?
Can you tell tell me what state you live in?
This is California. He's
talking. California. Okay,
oh,
thank
I beg
you.
Your pardon, dear. Oh. I thought you sounded like you were so close by.
Well,
she
we're
is.
All friends here.
Yeah.
I would think it unlikely that it's wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the deer are close to your house. I bet you have some great landscaping there and some lovely shade. And it's also possible that there's coyotes near where you live.
Mountain lions. Yeah, mountain lions would probably be the apex predator around here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Got it. Yeah. I know I got a mountain lion up here, but he doesn't bother anybody.
Well, you know, there's some real wonderful stories about people who habituate bears and get into big trouble doing that.
Oh, right.
So
right.
you feed the wild animals, and the wild animals become tame animals and then dependent upon you to take care of them.
That's a very important point. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for the call, Wayne.
Okay.
Well, and in a real sense, that's what we're trying to guard against here in reintroducing wolves to the West, isn't it? Is it not? We're trying to keep them wild and yet have them running around in the neighborhood, so to speak. How do we can we do both?
I think we can do both. If I didn't think we could do both, I never would have stepped up to the plate to transition in my professional life here. You know, I think of our national parks as very, very special places. I have some great memories of visiting Yellowstone myself as a little kid. But our national parks really are a postage stamp in a much larger landscape that includes other wild places as well as agricultural lands and us. And so wildlife needs to be able to access and use all of it if we're going to sustain it into that future. And so by necessity, that does mean some problem solving and solving conflicts. And sometimes it means that the wolf is killed or the black bear that has habituated to a human food source is killed.
Carolyn Syme,
we're
out of time, but boy, thank you so much. You have been wonderful, and what a wonderful story reintroduction of wolves is. Thank you so much for joining us, Carolyn.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael, and check back with us again in the future. Let's not be strangers.
Will do.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.